The following is one of a series of spiritual conferences given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J. Father Hardin is a professor of theology and teaches at the Pontifical Institute for Advanced Studies in Catholic Doctrine at St. John's University, New York. Father is well known as a lecturer, retreat master, and author. These conferences are deigned to help everyone, priest, religious, or layman, who is seriously striving for perfection to advance in the spiritual life. They will be worth listening to over and over again to delve into the depths of the truths of our faith. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, the apostolate in every vocation to follow Christ. Father Hardin.
I believe it is worth asking ourselves, why should we study this subject? Now, there are many reasons, but I think one of the most practical reasons in the church today is what is happening to so many religious communities. I believe that many of them are becoming dismembered. That, I think, is a good word. They are becoming dismembered because they have lost or forgotten the apostolic purpose for their foundation. And once you lose your sense of purpose, then anything can happen. You can have people, you can have money, you can have resources, but you will no longer have, at least for a long time, a religious community. Religious life, I'm still on the introduction, is not an abstraction, though we can talk about it in the abstract, but it is not lived out in the abstract. It is either lived out in a specific community with a specific apostolic purpose, or it soon becomes a religious community only in name. I think this bears more than passing emphasis. We used to, and we still do, correctly stress the primacy of the spiritual, the interior sanctification, and we cannot overstress the importance of that. But in order to have the community survive as a community, it must have a purpose beyond itself. In other words, religious life is not, if it's to remain religious life, narcissistic. It cannot be withdrawn into itself. It must have a finality which somehow it serves beyond itself. Our focus or reflection for the present lecture will be on a series of aspects of the overall theme of how the apostolate is essential to every vocation, specifically four areas. First, the meaning of vocation in general, very broad perspective. Then, what is the meaning of vocation to a special following of Christ? Third, the relationship of a vocation to the religious life and the apostolate. And finally, some theological implications. The meaning of a vocation. In general, we may say that God has a vocation for every believer in Christ. Now, we could say, but we'd have to be changing the meaning of words, that every human being has a vocation, but then we'd be outside the ambit of Christianity. Now, the reason we can put it the way I did is that it is already a vocation to have been called to be a Christian. And among Christians, to be a Catholic. This already is a vocation, which, unfortunately, not everyone appreciates. And the more you deal, as I have for the last 15 years, with the non-Christian religious systems, you are spontaneously moved to gratitude to God for having been called, because all we had to do was to have been born in Tokyo or in Bangkok or you name it, and through no fault of ours, we would have been, well, whatever we would have been. Talk about a special grace to have been called to be Christians and among Christians, Catholics. Consequently, we assume that Christianity and Catholic Christianity is already a vocation, indeed the primordial vocation. But then within the ambit of Catholic Christianity, what is a vocation? I would say that every Christian vocation, that is, every vocation of a Christian, has certain features. More could be added. I single out four. It is, first of all, selective. Though within the ambit of Christianity, we should say that everyone has a vocation, since evidently not everyone has the same vocation. God must be selective in whom he calls to what vocation. Some this, some that. Our parents had one vocation, we have another. Some manage in a lifetime to cover a number of vocations. And is it definite that Mother Seton will be canonized? I understand it is. An extraordinary woman. How many vocations was it? Well, she was a single woman before she married. She married. She was widowed. And then she became a religious. That's a lot of vocations for one lifetime. But that is extraordinary. So first of all, it is selective. But second, it is gratuitous. On the part of God, it is given as a grace. And the essence of grace, or part of its essence, is its gratuity. Meaning that God calls whom he wants, to what he wants, no questions asked of the one whom he calls. He gives it freely. It is further gratuitous in that it is offered as an opportunity. We do not, in precise theological language, receive a vocation to be saved. That's an obligation. Vocation implies gratuity on God's part and opportunity on ours. Now, sometimes you read in some spiritual writers that if a person does not follow his or her special vocation, they endanger their salvation. Well, a very probable opinion. And it would not be just because the person, say, did not follow through on a given vocation It would be through, well, neglect of God's grace or other reasons. Otherwise, the whole theology of vocation just collapses. You cannot talk about it unless you put it on the level of gratuity on God's part and opportunity on ours. It's a gift. It is something offered. And a gift, by definition, you may accept. And indeed, the giver appreciates your accepting his gift. But it's not something which the one who gives a gift demands, kind of a contradiction, to oblige a recipient to accept the gift. Third, every vocation within Christianity is purposeful. Now, this will be the key that we will use to further unlock the relationship of the apostolate to vocation. God calls certain to certain ways of life. Now, behind vocation is the idea of a lifelong calling. That is something to which a person then, when he or she responds, gives him or herself in a lifelong commitment. So the idea of commitment is built into the notion of vocation, and therefore its lifelong character. It's in intention. God may, for various reasons, do things into the person's life, but as far as the person is concerned, he or she must intend to make a total commitment, which means a lifelong commitment. Thus, there is a vocation to marriage, a vocation to the priesthood, a vocation to the single state in the world, a real vocation, which, by the way, we need to help people to understand. It's a real vocation, and a vocation to the religious life. Fourth and finally, each vocation is distinctive. Now, this is a sort of correlative to number one. It is selective as to persons. It is distinctive as to the way of life to which different people are called. Now, behind that notion of distinctiveness is something that might not strike the eye when we first meet it. In God's thinking, as we now can look back at 1900 years of vocationing, so to speak, that there are certain categories of distinctive ways of life, so that certain type of people, now we don't want to overdo this, but certain kinds of people with certain qualities of nature, and especially certain gifts of grace, what shall we say, sort of migrate towards certain types of vocation. Makes sense, right? And consequently, when we speak of vocation, we imply always some kind of communitarian life to which the person is called, so that other people in like manner will have a similar call. Otherwise, they'd never get together. Or if they happen to get together, they wouldn't stay together. Am I clear? So that this distinctiveness is not so much selectiveness for the person, but rather distinctive features of different forms within these major ways of life, so that we then have, say, within the religious state, different families, different communities, and the very variety and multiplicity of religious communities in the Catholic Church indicates, and all we're doing is, we're just thinking God's thoughts after Him. He does certain things, then we theologize. That's one of my definitions for theology. Thinking thoughts after God has done something. Try to figure out, now, Lord, why did you do it? So he classifies people, and he gives grace to people so that they might get together, and then not merely survive together, but actually enjoy living and working together for a common enterprise. Those are the four features of all authentic vocation. We now address ourselves to a vocation to Christian perfection. I use this terminology in order to keep it still one step removed from the religious life properly so-called, though within, of course, this vocation to Christian perfection is surely vocation to the religious life. A vocation to a life of Christian perfection is a special call to some people. And we've got to remind ourselves that a vocation is a call, which means it's something that we, symbolically speaking, hear. Otherwise, what good is the call if you can't hear it? Which means somehow with a mind you recognize it, giving you, as we've seen, some basis for making a choice. Now, it must be a special call to some people, not only because you've got different vocations, and therefore this vocation being different is special in that sense, but the word special has a special meaning. It is not only special in being different, it is special in being unique, so that only those who have received the grace really can live out the way of life which Christian perfection implies. Its foundations, as we know, are already in the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament. Thus, the call of the apostles was a call to Christian perfection. The call of the disciples, among whom we should remind ourselves were women. Mary Magdalene had a vocation. We may be sure, to Christian perfection. And she was quite a character before she had that call, which is also good to remind ourselves. The rich young man who had the vocation, but it couldn't have been clearer, but he exercised his freedom, didn't he? Notice what he chose. He chose not to follow the call that Christ gave him, and Matthew tells us, because he had much money. The development of this vocation to Christian perfection was already seen before the deliverance of the church from the early years of persecution and until about the 4th century was mainly eremitical, hermits. It's about all they could do. They could hardly get any kind of civil status in the Roman Empire. The problem at that time was even to survive as an individual Christian. So so. But as the church developed, three types, and they have survived to the present day. I shouldn't really have said that, because they will continue, we are sure, until the end of time. In general, there are three forms. Now, there are exceptions, but by and large, most states of perfection now fall into the strictly monastic, which may be eremitical, but that's rare. There are very few hermits in the Roman Catholic Church. Now, that has many variants. The cloistered community would qualify under that general rubric. Then what are called apostolic communities, where they engage in some kind of apostolic work which carries their efforts, even though not the persons, outside of their own community life. And thirdly, secular institutes. There was a fourth category contemplated by the Holy See in anticipation of the new code of canon law. We don't know what's going to happen because the code is not out yet, but if possible, to do something for the thousands of women that seem not to want religious life and yet seem to want, and of course everything hangs on whether they really want it, to live a specially dedicated life in the church, but not as religious. Now, the secular institutes are a recent development of the Catholic Church. There may then be a fourth category, but we won't know until it happens. At any rate, if there was a fourth category, it would be some form of what we now call secular institutes, with whatever implications still have to be worked out. Now, the classification I gave, because it's commonplace, there was monasticism, there are what we generally call religious communities, and there are secular institutes. Yes. Scores of subdivisions under each, especially the second category. However, that classification, though surely a correct one, is based on structure. It is not based on the essential qualities of every vocation to Christian perfection. This bears emphasis, that members of secular institutes are as much called to a life of Christian perfection as the most cloistered nun or monk, or as any of us. So it is rather the structure of their way of life that allows for this very important classification. Now, the essential features of every life of Christian perfection, you see why I did this, in order to keep religious life for one further stage, so we don't get things mixed up, that we make sure that there is something about Christian perfection which has certain essential qualities, whether it's monastic, or, I suppose, more popular language, cloistered, or whether it's a religious community, which is not strictly cloistered, or whether it's a secular institute. Those two indispensable features recognized by the Church are, first, a special call from Christ to follow Him. There is then a vocation to pursue holiness. That's the first feature. It's essential. Anyone who is called to a life of Christian perfection, if he or she has the vocation, has received the grace to become holy, and in no ordinary sense. Otherwise, you wouldn't qualify as a vocation to Christian perfection. But secondly, besides a special call from Christ to follow him in his footsteps, as far as it is possible according to the person's capacity, to imitate his life. Secondly, a special mission from Christ to cooperate with him in the apostolate. Both features are essential to a life of Christian perfection, and they are inseparable. You cannot have the one without the other. Thus, on the vocation side, it is a grace from Christ, and its immediate focus is that I might be sanctified. But Christ never separates that call from the mission. So it is both a vocation from Christ and a mission from Christ, where apostolate is just another word for mission. What is this? This is the purpose designated by Christ for which the grace of vocation has been given. In other words, my call to holiness does not stop with me. It's to somehow pass through me to others who, because of me, will then themselves be sanctified. Are we clear? So much then for vocation to Christian perfection. Now the relationship of vocation and apostolate in the religious life. Consequent on all we've seen, since religious life is a state of Christian perfection, not the only form, but one form, it then must have a twofold purpose: the sanctification of the religious and the sanctification of others by the religious. The two here are intimately and necessarily related. Now, the relationship is bilateral. In other words, the call to become holy ourselves bears a relationship to the purpose for which we were called to sanctify others, and that purpose has its bearing on our own sanctification. There are myriad interconnections. Let me just point out some of them.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.